You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Nick.
I have a question for you, man.
Yes.
If you needed headshots for your profession.
Which I don't.
Which you don't. You don't. Nobody needs to know what you look like. For someone who I consider such a close friend, I would rather not have a visual of their face. You know, but yeah, you don't have any. But if you were one of those people, one of those thespians who needed headshots, would you go get a headshot and consider you're in New York, okay? So numbers are low. It seems like the person who is doing the shoot has taken precautions. Would you go get these headshots now?
Okay, I need a clarifying question.
Yeah.
I do have Google.
Yeah.
So I can confirm that you already have an ungodly number of headshots.
I do. I think that I need to get more, especially as I try more and more for film TV. Those headshots are very generic, Nick, and that's kind of one of the sucky things about our industry is that, like, you actually, the more that you can suggest, like for me to send in those headshots that I have and be like, hey, see me for a firefighter or see me for a lawyer when I'm dressed in, like, generic Henley shirt and vest. But I'm also like, hey, there's a pandemic.
Here is a reality that I have gleaned from all the classic actors of Hollywood past.
Yeah.
And that is, you can't be in a movie if you're dead.
Little justice, little justice, little justice. Fuck yeah.
So Nick,
yes.
So between the cold open and right now, you've just laid several personal problems on me that we won't include,
but we'll
acknowledge that they've been there. Could it be that you're alone right now? That
Alex,
you're starting your life without your wife around?
It could. First of all,
do you just need someone to, like, vent to? Is this, I'm here to host a podcast with you.
First of all, welcome to
your sensei.
Welcome, you know, to Little Fucking Justice. First of all, our podcast. I'm trying not to swear, Mr. Smolo. I'm trying not to swear. Welcome to Little Justice. Yes, Alex, I am alone. My wife has left me. And there's several things, you know, what you guys missed in the cut scene between the cold open and now is that I, as Alex said, I did lay several issues at his feet that I'm experiencing,
which I'm happy as a friend to. I just feel like that's a pretty good segue.
It's
given
a
today's
great
theme.
Segue in today's theme, you know,
and also mental health check. You know, how you doing,
dude? It's, I will say this, like, what I will say is, like, part of, you know, so for those of you who don't know, my wife left for grad school, you know, this a couple weeks ago. And so I've been alone now 2 weeks, not as, having the cat here is really helpful. And, like, that makes things better. I've been making a point of, like, going to see friends and, you know, socially distance, going to see friends. So, like, you know, staying 6 feet apart, keeping masks on. I've had one or two hangout sessions, but mostly, you know, 90% of the time I'm in this house. It's definitely a little, you know, it's wearing on my mind a little bit. Absolutely. I think, but then I also think about people who have done this for 4 months now. And I'm like, good Lord, y'all. Like, God bless you, man. Cause this
has been a grind.
This is real.
I realize, like, I don't really leave the apartment. I go grocery shopping and that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's insane.
And I've just gotten so used to it at this point.
It's insane. But that's what pisses me off, because that's us. But then you go across the pond, and I keep saying this, you go right across the pond and people are, like, out and living their lives.
Well, yeah, because they're handling it properly. They did their legwork.
Oh, my God.
We've got half the population thinking that masks are some kind of, like, Illuminati ploy to get people to do, I don't know what, live.
Yeah. Hydroxychloroquine and all that bull.
Like, yeah. I'm constantly befuddled by the state of our nation and our nation's minds right now. Like, everybody, how we get to this point, you know?
No, true.
Like, everybody lives in this little techno bubble. They're just on their phone and watching, you know, the news, which is being catered to, you know, these kind of, I'll call them weak minds.
Yeah.
You know, I would choose my words more carefully, but, like, it's past that point. These are weak minded people.
Here's what I will say. I will say that I understand that we have a culture that has propagated this kind of thinking. So it's not like it is blameless, right? You're not just the mountain that you're scaling is a mountain of, like, people's understanding of what it means to be American that has been only buttressed by the past 80 to 100 to 400 years of history. So, like, I get that. But at a certain point, your individual freedom is irrelevant to the communal need. And I'm not
saying... the messages have gotten mixed. You know, the idea of patriotism and being an American has changed. Like, it's not about being an American, because being an American is, you know, is knowing the Constitution and what your constitutional rights are, and seeing injustice when it happens and speaking out again. Like, the country's born of violent conflict based on inequality and injustice. Like, that's what America is. But somehow the message has been skewed to be like, if you want any change at all, you're a terrible person and un-American.
And it's also for those people who are, you know, proud to call themselves nationalists, I mean, it's a perversion of the actual definition of a nationalist, which is somebody who, you know, if you were a nationalist, you would be supporting the country's interests.
Right.
Like, that's the irony. Like, you actually aren't if you're doing this, you are...
They're nationalists for a Confederate nation that doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And literally, and again, granted, a nation that we did nothing to supplement once we obliterate.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So, like, there is so much history wrapped up in this, but all that to say, it comes down to this whole thing of, like, you know, I'm stuck wondering if it's safe for me to go get new headshots, which I potentially need for my career. Like,
right.
And that's, again, that is a minuscule choice, but, like, that is not a choice that should be stressing me out right now.
Do you mean, like, every single person has a choice like that.
Yeah.
Or several choices like that almost every day.
Every day,
like,
now.
That proliferates out into the universe. And, like, if everybody is having to make weird little sacrifices like that, and some people aren't, and exacerbating the problem by ignoring it or getting angry about it or being scared of it. We're living in very interesting times.
We're living. And if you're hearing this podcast, that means you're breathing and you got choices and you got options. And
I hope.
Listen.
I
hope you're breathing too. And I say that sincerely. I hope you are finding time to breathe. Because that is so important, and that it's also so valuable. But in answer to your question, and back to the theme of today, which is, of course, we are talking about movies. How would you call this? I mean, specifically for me, I would say the movies that keep my sanity in line when my wife has left me.
I had an idea for the title.
What's the title?
Feel free to reject it, but the title can be "When the Wife Is Away, This Movie Will Play."
that's good and it's so funny. So I have to tell you guys, when we originally thought of this, or when Alex brought this title to me, like, I immediately, I was like, yes. But it took us a second to realize that we had two very different understandings of what
very different meant. Ideas yeah,
like, there was one really skeezy understanding of it, which was like, oh, like, yeah, what are the movies you watch when your wife's gone?
Like, yeah. What can we watch now that she would never let us watch?
But my understanding of it was like, oh, my wife is gone. what is the movie that makes me feel better about, like...
Which I like a lot more. Yeah, than pivoting
it's a much... I just want to make clear, that is what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the other thing. We're not about to go into, like, you know...
This is a feel-good episode, not like a...
Not like a porn... You
know, turn off the lights and pour a wine episode.
Yeah, like, not like a porn feel-good, but like an actual feel-good. No, so
we'll get to a porn
episode. Oh, we should absolutely get to a porn episode. I would love doing a porn episode on this. I think that would be a great... Those porn movies, some of them are just hysterical.
They're pretty blatant.
Blatant is, like... is definitely a word for it, you know. But yeah, so the best movie, you know, when you're home alone during quarantine, and this applies to anyone who is experiencing this lonely time during quarantine, you know, what is that movie that you watch that is either cathartic for you or just makes you, you know, get those cries out?
Yeah, so let me ask you, so, like, when you think of a movie like that, what's your goal with this movie? Is it to try to get rid of the loneliness? Is it to try to understand the loneliness and, like, kind of wallow in it a little bit? Like, what is the headspace you're trying to get into?
See, this is where I'm different. This is where me and my wife differ. I think that where her mind often goes, I think she absolutely loves a good cathartic movie. And P.S., if you hear, like, grinding in the background, like, just know that, like, they are building a
orthodontist.
I'm in an orthodontist office. No, they're building a goddamn, like, they built a CubeSmart across from my home, and now they are putting, I think it's some sort of parking structure. I don't know what it is, but there's a lot of tin roofing happening. There's, like, a lot of drilling, you know, so it's kind of bull. But just know that that's what that is. On top of that, all this to say, I think Sarah, if you were to ask her, she definitely has movies that, like, are cathartic. Like, sometimes when she's really stressed, she just wants to watch, like, a good horror movie and just, like, scream it out and laugh it out and all that stuff. But I also think as this quarantine went deeper, I think that she found herself in a place of, like, wanting to or needing to watch these movies that were just like kind and like made her feel good about life and all this stuff. I'm kind of in the middle. I want to see a character who I can relate to in the moment. That's, I think, what has always done something for me, is like a character who's maybe feeling what I feel, and whether or not they find a resolution to that, I think that just watching them experience it is helpful for me to get some sort of closure.
So it's relating. I mean, do you think part of that is not acting like they're there with you, but using that human presence like to...
Yeah, I think, well, because I mean, what is a good, you know, what is a good story but a portal for us to like look at ourselves and be like, what would I do in those situations? And sometimes you see somebody who's the best of you, and sometimes you see somebody who's the worst of you, and you know, it is what it is. But I just, yeah, for me, I'm like, I need to see someone in a similar position, and that helps me. Is that the same? I mean, what are you on the same wavelength?
Yeah, it's pretty similar to, because I thought about it for a while, and I had a couple choices picked out, and I realized kind of, you know, I want to see somebody in the position I'm in and kind of relate to it, kind of, you know, not specifically like somebody who's sitting at home while their wife is gone.
Yeah.
But somebody, I was drawn towards movies about isolation and drawn towards movies about, you know, struggles with the self and just being okay in empty space, and, you know, films that projected that out into something, into a set piece or, you know, a time period or something that represents, you know, isolation, that represents loneliness, that, you know, kind of that hollow echo. How do you visualize the hollow echo of loneliness?
You know? It's so funny because as you talk about this, I feel like there's a 90 or not even, I'd say 80% chance that we might have chosen the same film.
You think so?
I think we
might. I would be both very surprised and not really surprised.
I mean, so let me ask you this. Do you think that there is an era of filmmaking that has captured this feeling better? Do you think that a lot of modern films deal with what you're describing?
I think a lot of modern films that we've never seen probably do, because low budget filmmaking is ripe with this kind of stuff.
Yes.
Because you need very few actors and very few set pieces, right? It's kind of the challenge of with no money, how do you make something? And that's kind of how I made my feature back in the day. You know, it was like, we don't have a lot of money. We have one location. How do we do this?
Yeah.
How do we just make something and then what comes out the other end? So I think a lot of low budget filmmaking, I mean, from the 70s onward, there's not too much indie filmmaking going on before then, or at least nothing that, you know, was super widespread. But I think you do see a lot of it. And a lot of it always I watch movies like this, and my first thought is like, this should be on a stage, right? Like movies like this usually can end up on a stage also.
It's so funny that you say that, because I actually was thinking, I was going through my head, racking my brain, you know, loneliness and longing are very hard to, I was trying to think of like a Broadway play or a Broadway musical that I've seen that does that, that captures that essence. And there are Broadway, I think there's a lot of musicals that might flirt with that theme. And please, by the way, if you have any Broadway musicals that you think flirt with this theme, tweet at us at Little Justice Pod. Let us know if you thank you. Thank you. Plugging.
Little Justice.
One of the things I was thinking about, it's how hard it is to capture loneliness on stage. I mean, the entire concept of stage, film is a visual medium, stage is an auditory medium. We're going to hear it before we see it necessarily. Like, that's why you deal with a lot broader colors and on stage, and a lot, you know, because it really is about the ear first, and then the visual, the nuance of the visual can kind of seep in. Whereas on film, you know, it really, that visual can tell you the entire story. But on stage with loneliness, you have this open space, and it should be this thing that, like, I would really love to see, and maybe this is my next script or something, but like, I would love to capture loneliness on stage. I just think that that's a
well,
really...
I mean, this stage is a lonely place, though. It's if with one person in the middle of a stage with a giant dark space around them and a spotlight, like that's a pretty... I feel like you can communicate a lot. You just have to be trusting of your audience that they're going to pick up on it, right? You can't like try to broadcast and dialogue what you're trying to get across. Like, it'd be very personal to the space that you perform this thing in.
Yeah.
But I think even in like a black box theater, if you got really creative and you had a good script with a good arc, you know, that had a story that could carry, And it'd probably be some, it'd probably be like a one man monologue. See, that's, show, I was, but I think you could do it.
So I, there was a, Dennis O'Hare did a, an amazing one man show called, or one person show, I should say, cause women have performances as well, called The Iliad, or An Iliad is what it was called. And it's literally the story of the Odyssey, and Odysseus' journey back home, but told by, like they would have told it in the actual times by one storyteller. And very much captures kind of a modern spin on what those, what it would have felt like to sit down with a storyteller and have him or her tell you this tale. So, you know, it's not just like, you know, him acting as Odysseus. It's him really communicating with you and throwing all sorts of examples around and funny. And, but it's, I mean, it's very amazing. It's a very athletic performance and script to read and performance to watch. And I'd always, the idea that I'd always had that I might play with, because honestly, and then the more I think about it, I'm like, that'd actually be a great script to write during this time. I always wanted to try writing like a version, some sort of epic story told by one person, but told to themselves during Hurricane Katrina. Like they're trapped in an attic in New Orleans during this hurricane, and how, like very much like almost like a castaway on stage, like how do you amuse yourself when you're alone? How do you keep that fire going in yourself when you're alone? And totally. Like hearing the wind outside and knowing that there's water in the floorboards underneath, but you have to make this thing happen for yourself. You
right.
know? I'd
watch that.
Oh, I'd watch it too. I mean, I'd honestly watch the movie version of that. I wouldn't, the movie would be I think you'd have to either do it as a short or like a really tight 90 minutes.
127 hours.
Dude.
In Hurricane Katrina.
In Hurricane Katrina. But I think you could do it. I think it could be a really fascinating story.
I think so. A good friend of mine who I want to bring on the show eventually.
Which one is this?
He's great. Larry Cedar.
Oh,
the character actor.
Yeah.
Larry Cedar. He's a phenomenal actor. He's been working since the 70s, probably 70s or 80s. He's been, you know, you'd recognize him if you saw him.
If any of you are Deadwood fans as I am,
Yes, he's Leon, the opium dealer on Deadwood.
He's amazing.
So Larry, over the past couple of years, he writes and stages one-man shows based on literature.
I love that.
So he's done Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. He did a compilation of George Orwell's novels, and he does them all by himself, just costume changes and bare props, and basically takes the narration and digests it as like, an onstage narrator as the character. He like inhabits the character and tells the story, but doesn't have the book, obviously. So he's like, how do you tell this to a book narration, something being written down, talk to you? Like, how do you broadcast the whole story? And then, I've shot and recorded a couple of them. They're really, I'm sure you can find them online somewhere. I think he's posted them. It's fascinating watching story work for an hour and a half with just one person and the worlds you can build or not build, just based on what you say and the movements that you make. It's fascinating.
No. And like, if you have an actor like a Larry Cedar or like a Dennis O'Hare or anybody who's just, you know, I mean, people who really just know how to command the stage.
Yeah.
I mean, a one person show or even a one person movie, Robert Redford did that incredible, movie. All is Lost. And I mean, it was just him out there. I mean, and no words really. I don't remember any words in All is Lost.
And the director, J.C. Chandor, is phenomenally talented. Yes. I had a chance to meet him when his first movie, Margin Call, came out. I remember talking
to him. Oh my God, Margin
Call. Down to Earth, dude, and all this stuff. But like somebody who just really understands tone. Margin Call is so good.
So, and it's, I mean, he really is low key. I mean, looking at Margin Call, and what was the one that he just had on Netflix this past summer with it was like Oscar Isaac, Ben Affleck. It was like a back to old
it was like a, Mando yeah film. it was a few years ago now,
was it? Oh my God,
I think it was called A Most Violent Year, 2014.
Most Violent Year. No, well that, okay, no, that was one, but no, he also had,
oh, he did Triple Frontier.
He did Triple Frontier. That was 2019.
Oh,
yes, he did.
I didn't know that was him.
Yes, he did.
Was that good?
It was, you know what? It was, I will say.
The cast is phenomenal.
The cast was phenomenal. Ben Affleck, like it was, again, I really do think that Ben Affleck gets the short end of the stick because he really is a solid actor, especially when you put him in the right role. I think there was some, there was just like some pacing things that got to me, but like tone, but again, tonally, it was like right on the mark. And the performances were great, and the tension was great. really just like a throwback to like those old school, you know, like, you know, movies with like, you know, guys on a heist, bunch of commandos being,
you know, speaking of recent auteurs and movies about isolation and loneliness, in the complete opposite direction of something like All Is Lost, that's very big and visual. Have you seen Ghost Story?
No. Do I need to?
Ghost Story is a film by David Lowery.
Sarah has wanted me to see this for so long. Yes.
So David Lowery had directed Ain't Them Bodies Saints, which was kind of like a cult indie hit. And off of that, he went and somehow you go from Ain't Those Bodies Saints to Pete's Dragon.
I love it.
The Disney film. He obviously like flew across the world to film Pete's Dragon in New Zealand or something. And he got so kind of like exhausted from that, he had this idea for a film called Ghost Story. And all he wanted to do was do it to just get over a giant Disney production, right? To just like with his friends go off and make a super low budget. The budget's like $100,000. All the actors just kind of working on whatever. And it's shot in 1:1 aspect ratio, you know, with like a 16 millimeter camera, about a guy, you know, a couple, and the guy dies in a car accident and gets stuck. You know, he becomes a ghost, basically just a dude with a sheet over his head. And it's very like existential, philosophical. You know, he gets stuck in the house as the woman, you know, she moves out and moves on with her life, and he stays there. And, you know, through the next people who move in, and the house gets demolished, and then it becomes a city in the future. And he just wanders, and it's haunting. It's so good.
And it's not at all connected to Ain't Them Bodies Saints, right? Because the same actors.
I don't believe so. Okay. No, they were just his friends.
That's awesome.
Because they'd made it, and they're like, hey, I have this idea. He didn't even have a script when they went to make it. He was kind of writing it as they went. A lot of the dialogue's just kind of improvised. It's very moody. It's not like let's sit down and be entertained by this. It's like, no, let's sit down and watch this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Rooney Mara eats an entire pie in one go, in one shot. It's pretty insane.
I love that. I think that's, I mean, look, again, when you know, I think experimentation, especially in film, is something that can only yield, you know,
oh my God,
interesting results.
It's yielded bad things, but it also has yielded very good things.
Very good things. So I'm in. I'm always in for some experiment. But, you know, I think tone is a huge, if you're talking about movies that like, you know, are like lonely movies, tone is a huge part. And that's why when I'm thinking about the film that I chose today, tonally, it is actually like it's.
Oh, I'm so curious.
Oh, I think you will know it as soon as I start talking about it. I know we always say that. We say that every time. But I really, this is a film that like only in rewatching it did I realize how many of my favorite archetypes and scenarios come from this film. And I really think that it captures just that feeling of neutral and stuck and, you know, really, really well. You want to dive into it?
Yeah, let's dive into it. You start this time.
I'll start. Okay. So my movie opens on a map of the known world. It's black and white, some music, some really triumphant studio music like we haven't heard in 70 years. And then there's some narration just talking about the state of things.
We chose the same movie.
Did we?
Yeah.
I know we did. I knew we did. It really is.
I can't believe it.
It's the best. I mean, when you're thinking about those feelings, dude, it's the best movie. It's the best movie. And the best part that I love is one thing, you know, you talk about loneliness, you are literally introduced to your hero maybe 15 minutes in, and before that you're seeing all these people talk. I mean, so, you know, to continue the description, you open on, you don't know if it's an island, you know, I mean, you know, it's a place, it's a neutral grounds, but you hear.
Oh my God, we didn't choose the same movie.
What, we didn't? Oh, flip.
We did. Same opening.
Same opening, but different movie.
Different movie.
Interesting. Okay, well, I'm gonna continue to describe my movie. Do you know?
Wow.
Do you know what my movie is though?
Keep going.
I mean, you do. I know you do because everyone does. So we open, like I said, open on a map, and then go to some narration of you hearing about the world. The world is on the brink of war, or in the midst of war, and there's one neutral ground, kind of like a limbo where people who are trying to get out of this country can go as they're awaiting their ticket out. Okay. And you open on this town and you hear that there's like somebody comes over a radio and you're in like kind of a soldier's place and they're like, please be warned, two German perpetrators are out and about, you know, trying to do something. And, you know, you follow them and then you see these guys, you see like this, you know, one of the police officers on the street, like comes up to this couple. He's like, please be careful. There's somebody going around. And he's, you know, and then one of the guys that like he's talking about bolts, right? He runs off and they runs to the streets. They capture him. And then another couple is watching this guy being captured, like, oh my God, what is going on over there? And they're like two vacationers. And this guy's like, hey, listen, you got to be real careful around here. There's a lot of crazy things going on. You don't know who to trust. You know what I mean? The couple's like, oh my God, well, thank you. Thank you, good man. Thank you. Thank you. And the man pats the gentleman of the couple on the back. He's like, you're welcome. Don't even worry about it. He leaves. And then the gentleman, they're sitting at a coffee table. The waiter comes over. He goes to the couple, the man and the couple goes to pay his check. And he's, oh my God, my wallet's missing. Oh, stop him. Stop that thief. And they run after the thief. And you realize through all of this, you are in a place called Casablanca.
Who do you think? I know there is gambling in there. There is no secret. You dare not keep me out of here.
Yes, what's the trouble?
These gentlemen... I have been in every gambling room between Honolulu and Berlin. And if you think I'm going to be kept out of a saloon like this, you're very much mistaken.
Excuse me, please.
Hello, Harry. Your cash is good at the bar.
What? Do you know who I am?
I do. You're lucky the bar's open to you.
This is outrageous. I shall report it to the angry.
Ah.
Casablanca. La, 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 la.
It's been so long since I've seen that.
So let me tell you. So me and Sarah watched it. So there was this, used to be a couple years back. Still in existence. Rooftop Cinema Club was this really cool thing where you could watch it exactly like the title says. It's cinema on a rooftop. And you watch it and like, they set up these giant screens and you put headphones on and you could get like specialty seats where you could sit with your popcorn and like, it actually could be a really cool thing to do in us, you know, in these times, you know, but it's just a really great kind of thing. You can watch the movies with the sunset in the background. And this was one of the ones that I took her to and she had never seen it. She found it a little boring and like by today's standards, it definitely is. Like, it's not a movie that's, like, gonna grab...
It's funny, like, I wasn't even thinking about, like, you so rarely go for any movie before even, like, 1985.
I know, I was stretching. Like, I was stretching.
I'm not at all thinking, like, oh, maybe it's a classic film.
Well, that's and I realize, like, so many, you know, Rick as a character, Humphrey Bogart, the late, great Humphrey Bogart as Rick is just... You know, watching him, you know, I'm in the middle of writing a new script right now. And like the biggest thing that I, you know, this was a commission and the biggest thing I wanted to add to the script was like grit. So my central character is literally like Dr. House. Like I just steal like that idea of somebody who's like just an asshole in the mid, but like has a good, like has a heart of gold, mm-hmm. but like is, you know, is never going to let you know it. And that all to me started with the Humphrey Bogart and his characterizations. Maltese Falcon, it's very similar thing, but this one,
that just the generational male,
yeah,
the 1940s, like very like, you know, misogynistic with a heart of gold kind of thing.
And it's and like, again, you know, lose the misogyny, but keep the asshole. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I think that there's such a cool thing, and what I, you know, if you're talking about a movie that deals with loneliness, right, the kind of the whole point of this movie, mm-hmm. is regret. Like, that's what so much of this movie is about the life that you could have led.
Why did you come back to tell me why you ran out on me at the railway station?
Yes.
Well, you can tell me now. I'm reasonably sober.
I don't think I will, Rick.
And these people are, you know, so Rick is kind of the ultimate, you know, dealer, right? Like, he is in charge of this Rick's bar in this, you know, island, in this neutral ground. He is friends with the Nazis and not friends with Nazis. He's cool with the Nazis. He's cool with the common folk. He's cool with the elite. Like, everyone loves Rick because Rick doesn't take sides. Rick is just in the middle. He's not going to hurt anyone. He's just trying to make his money and serve his drinks and whatever. You know what I mean? He has a dark, dark past, and that dark past on one night comes back to haunt him. And this woman from his past needs help getting her new love documents to get out of Casablanca. And Rick is flooded in this brilliant scene. He's flooded with memories of their relationship.
It's strange. I know so very little about you.
I know very little about you. Just the fact that you had your teeth straightened.
But be serious, darling. You are in danger and you must leave Paris.
No. We must leave.
Yes, of course, we.
Now, the train for Marseille leaves at 5 o'clock. I'll pick you up at your hotel at 4:30.
No, not at my hotel. I have things to do in the city before I leave. I'll meet you at the station.
All right. At 4:45. Say, why don't we get married in Marseille?
That's too far ahead to plan.
You know, for the first 30 minutes of this film, you've seen him as such like a dark and brooding individual. And then you just see him in this like light and airy place. And he's so happy to be with this woman. And then we go back and...
Boss.
Yeah?
Boss, ain't you going to bed?
Not right now.
Ain't you planning on going to bed in the near future?
No.
You ever going to bed?
No.
Well, I ain't sleepy either.
Good, then have a drink.
No, not me, boss.
Don't have a drink.
Boss, let's get out of here.
No, sir. I'm waiting for a lady.
Please, boss, let's go. Ain't nothing but trouble for you here.
Coming back? I know she's coming back.
We'll take the car and drive all night. We'll get drunk. We'll go fishing and stay away until she's gone.
Shut up and go home, will you?
No, sir. I'm staying right here.
And it's just such a simple performance. I think that's what makes it so beautiful is it really is just a man drowning himself in booze, lamenting this life.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And so is this what happens? So your wife goes out of town and you're finally on your own for the first time and who knows how long, and your inclination is to drown yourself in booze and lament?
Not exactly, but like also not far off. Like I will say, I had an experience last night where one of my friends was going to have a rooftop party and like we were all going to go. I posted about this on my Instagram.
Yes.
But like I was like, cool, like let's go out. Like I'm going to go out and like see some people. I made a chicken ratatouille. It's freaking delicious. I like got in a lift, went down to this friend's house, found out this party was not to that night, but was in 5 nights from now. And I was like, Jesus Christ. And it just, the loneliness just struck in harder than ever. And I literally went to like my local artisan beer shop and like got 3 cans of like mulberry sour and just drank. And I absolutely felt like Rick. like I very much felt like Rick. And it's, you know, it's just like this, it's this very strange, you know, I think what Casablanca definitely captures for that character is when you build those walls around yourself, those defenses, right, that Rick has built up, you are so alone with your thoughts. Yeah. And that is really the mind that's trapping you. And I think the brilliance of Casablanca is like he, by the end, he gains a friend. Like this, I forget if he's French, but the police officer who, mm-hmm. who's always, you know, who's like kind of his confidant, but also his greatest enemy, like, becomes kind of his friend. Like, you know what I mean? They're both stuck on this terrible place together as his love flies off. But I think that by the end of it, he's able to come to terms with where he's at and where she needs to be and doing the right thing, you know. And that it's a very right. bittersweet ending. But it really, yeah, especially for right now.
Yeah, there's like an ache to it, right? Yeah. It's like an aching or a longing.
Absolutely an ache.
The feeling of it. And I love the setting of Casablanca in terms of what it is like. And in talking about translating things to stage, like it has a very stagey feel, this kind of way station, right, between two places. It's such a ripe playground for things like people trying to get through, and it's kind of this medium space.
Oh, yeah.
Purgatory between places in the midst of this giant war. It's so ripe. Like, you don't really need to do much with it for it to feel a certain way.
No. And I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I think it actually is based on a play. I'm pretty sure that it's Everybody Comes to Rick's. I don't know if it was ever produced, but I think it was definitely based on a play.
Interesting. It makes sense.
And it makes complete sense because I love one location, you know, like things that like center around a central location. I love mm-hmm. stories like that. I mean, yes, it's a very theatrical conceit because in theater you have one unit set and it's all of a sudden the cheapest play to produce in the world. But it's also just that, you know, I think when the setting is just one thing, what do you focus on? But the characters.
Yeah.
And Casablanca right. is full of hugely memorable characters on both, you know, both the villainous side and the heroic side, all the people who are trying to get free, you know, they just break your heart. There's that one moment when they stand up and they sing their national anthem and you're just watching these people just stand in defiance of the Nazi regime. And you're like,
yeah,
hell yeah. Like, go for it. Yeah, man. So yeah, it was truly
Casablanca. I like that. Yeah, yeah. It's one of those movies. It's like, you know, all the famous scene. You played Against Sam and Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn, all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's
just because you can't.
Frankly, My Dear, I Don't Give a Damn is Gone with the Wind. That's Frank.
No,
Frankly, Miss Scarlet, I Don't Give a Damn.
Wait, what's the
This is Here's Looking at You.
What's the one at the end? Here's Looking at You.
Here's Looking at You, kid.
When I said I would never leave you,
and you never will. I've got a job to do too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. Now. He's looking at you, kid.
Yeah, yeah.
One of those things.
Could you not?
See, this shows my...
You gotta watch this again, bro. You gotta watch it.
The end, she's... Okay. Yeah, I really do. I mean, so you go through like, I feel like I've watched all the Citizen Kane. I've probably seen twice,
oh,
but
yeah.
All the other classics I've seen once where like, I don't, yeah, I get it.
I never
have the, you know, cause in film school, you're looking at the individual scenes,
yep.
the like still frames, the like you're reading the scripts and all this stuff, but like, you never go watch them for fun.
Not at all.
Except in this case, that's an interesting perspective on Casablanca.
Also, I'm on the Wikipedia page right now. I am shocked that Peter Lorre was not a first billed actor for this movie. Peter Lorre.
Oh my God. I love Peter Lorre so much.
So good.
Talking about character actors.
Oh my God.
He's the original.
He's the
character
guy.
Actor.
He is in one of my favorite. So Quentin Tarantino. Here's Tarantino again. We brought him up. We did it.
There he is. Ding, ding,
ding,
ding,
ding, ding, ding, ding,
ding.
Quentin Tarantino, his entry into the Four Rooms anthology film called The Man from Hollywood, which was based on The Man from the South by Roald Dahl, short story by Roald Dahl. And in the, I think it's like a Twilight Zone episode based on that short story, Peter Lorre plays the guy who is cutting off the fingers. And he is so creepy and so good. And it's the same thing. Like, he's just such a weird, interesting texture. And you're just like,
I remember because the genie does the imitation in Aladdin him was my first introduction to like him as a and I think Vincent Price has the same kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's like that from that era, just like the character, the real characters from that era.
Yeah, people who are literally there to fill out your film and give it like that weird feel.
Right.
You know.
Yes.
Yes. And it's, I mean, also very indicative of the time when, like, you know, a kind of a big-eyed foreigner is like your ultimate villain.
I'm sure that Peter Lorre has played one of every single race.
Oh, yeah.
In the film.
Yeah. It's kind of ridiculous. Kind of
I'm
ridiculous.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, man. But yeah, that's my pick is good.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. No, I like that. I like that a lot. It's interesting because my pick, as I think about it, thematically, these films are very, very similar. We chose them for the same reasons.
Okay.
They could not be more different, but they are a main character in one location dealing with themselves. You'll know it. It'll throw you back. We open on the world and a narrator, of course.
Yeah.
As I say, this time it's talking about, it's a newscast, it's an advertisement, it's a promotion. We're flashing through pictures of climate change, right? Gas being leaked into the atmosphere, ocean rising, cities, you know, using electricity,
as cities
tend to do. And then they're talking about the solution, but we figured out the solution. And we cut to grass in the desert, and we cut to children laughing on a playground, and then we finally cut to the moon.
I knew it. Yeah, you love this movie. You do love
it. I love this movie. The promotion ends. We go up to the moon. Where there's one man, Sam Bell, who works on a space station by himself on the moon, basically just managing the helium harvesters. Yeah, the film is Moon.
Rudy, have you heard anything new about anyone fixing lunar sat?
No, Sam. What I understand is it's fairly low on the company's priority list right now.
You tell them to sort that out. You know what I'm talking about? That's not... I've only got 2 weeks, but it's not fair to whoever's coming up here next.
I will, Sam. Do you want me to finish cutting your hair later?
Nah, come on, let's finish this.
I feel similar about Kevin Spacey's performance as Gertie in Moon that I do about Alan Rickman's performance in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where, you know, when you have a voiceover like this and you're never going to be seen... You know what I mean? Like, it's not like you don't, you know, it could very easily become, well, like, as much as I love Paul Bettany as Vision in the Marvel movies, him as Jarvis, like,
right. Great.
I mean, it's fine, but it's not anything memorable. But like,
oh, yeah.
When you have, and this is, I was going to ask you, you know, watching this now with everything that's come out about Kevin Spacey.
Yes, there are several things watching it now. So Moon is a film. It came out in 2009. The director is Duncan Jones. It was his first feature. He is better known as Ziggy Bowie, Zoe Bowie, David Bowie's son.
There you go.
Just for some background, stars Sam Rockwell. He later finds out in the film he's on the moon by himself. He gets into an accident and wakes up back at the base, then goes and finds himself in the rover where he had the accident. Turns out they're all clones being kept to operate the base, and then they basically just get replaced one after the other, and he figures this out and tries to get off the station. When it came out in 2009, where this was like junior year of college, whatever, it, conceptually, right, there hadn't been a movie like this in a very long time.
No.
Yeah. And you read any interview about it, and it's very, very directly related to Alien and to Outland, the Sean Connery movie, and all these like science fiction epics that are heady in their philosophy.
Yep.
Right. And at the time I thought, okay, like this is deep. This is good filmmaking. This is solid. Like, this is interesting. This is what more people should be doing is attempting to this. You know, this is a great performance, which it is. All of these things, I kind of elevated it in my mind.
Yep.
It's interesting watching it now, the perspective I have on it, how much it's changed. And that has not even that much to do with Kevin Spacey, who plays the AI, his AI friend, who, you know, the computer who rolls around the space station, and everything we've learned about Kevin Spacey recently. Like, yeah, it's weird, but the character is super, super flat. They hired Kevin Spacey after they'd already like shot the movie basically, and they showed him it, and he was like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do it. The budget was super low, and so it didn't really bother me hearing him there. What bothered me is when you stop and think about how much ripe potential there is in this scenario for character, for story, for exploration, how little they do with it.
Mm.
Like, it's literally the whole movie, the whole movie banks on you being surprised by finding out he's a clone.
Mm.
And then just being invested enough at that point to follow these characters to the conclusion. And it doesn't take that. Like, I would love to see this movie, and I think it would really, really translate to stage. This is a movie about a guy who is all alone and is forced to confront himself.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't get much better than this. Like, on a space station straight out of Alien.
Yes.
Like, this is the perfect environment for fantastic thematic, visual, character storytelling. Like, this is a playground for people like me. And I watched it through again this morning, and I was disappointed in how little it did with what it had.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's, you know, but it was, I remember even watching, like, and again, this is not a put down of it, because it is, there's so many moments in the film that are lovely, but even watching it when we used to watch it, back, you know, back in school, like, I'll put it like this. There Will Be Blood, as much as it is a film made by a filmmaker who loves making films for film people, is also a movie that has tremendous weight and like depth. And depth.
Yeah.
Moon does not quite sit with me in the same way.
Moon does not have the depth.
It doesn't have the depth.
Moon has style over substance, and it's pretty limited in style.
And granted, and what I will say is, when you put Sam Rockwell at the center of your film, do you know what I mean? Like, that is a man, if there was ever an actor who could carry a 95-minute movie of this context, it's Sam Rockwell.
You find your secret room? Just put that anywhere. Oh, that's a good idea. That's where I keep my leprechauns.
Get out of the way.
What? Why?
I want to look underneath that model.
You're not touching this model.
Get the fuck out of the way.
Listen, why don't you relax, okay? Why don't you take a pill, bake a cake, go read the encyclopedia.
You're a tough guy now? What, are you gonna stab me?
No, I'm a peaceful warrior. I'm a lover, I'm not a fighter.
Put the knife down.
Hey,
I want to look underneath there.
Put the knife down.
No, I'm not gonna give you the knife.
What?
Just get out of the way.
Take it easy, because I go with the knife. Don't ever tell me what to do.
At the time, there hadn't, like, the fact that it was Sam Rockwell acting against it, like a whole movie with one actor being split in two, which has been, you know, beaten to death by this point.
Yeah.
At the time was something to take note
of. Oh yeah.
And it gave Duncan Jones a whole career. And, you know, this film.
And it was, you know, it's, you talk about indie films, like, this was, you know, Sam Rockwell had not, you know, yes, he'd had many, many parts, but, like, we didn't know him as the Sam Rockwell that we know today yet. Do you know what I mean? We knew him as theater Sam Rockwell from Labyrinth Theater Company. We knew him as, like, New York stage Sam Rockwell, but it wasn't like this. And so this was definitely like, ooh, your favorite indie actor, your favorite indie sci-fi.
And I think it's the style that I'm talking about, which is why I chose it. It's what, because in my head I'm thinking, okay, like, if I'm by myself and I'm thinking by myself and I just kind of want, like, a meditative, slow movie about a guy, you know, with good music, and, you know, it's not going to be challenging, I'll watch it all the way through. Because, you know, if your wife's gone, she's also probably texting you at the same time. So you don't want to have to, like, engage too hard.
Yeah.
This one was wife approved.
Wife?
She said approved. I was wife approved, which even I told her this story. Because you can't do anything. Once you're married, there is no more just you,
no.
Right? Any decision you make, anything you do, there's no more just you. There's a story about James Cameron when he was doing his trip to the bottom of the Mariana Trench.
Yep.
And making a film about it and all that. He wanted to be the first person down to the deepest part of the ocean. And he did it. He was in his submersible and they lowered him further than anybody's ever been before. And he touched the bottom of the lowest part of the ocean and got a phone call from his wife.
and
so look at that. Let that be a lesson that you can be further away than anyone's ever been from humanity and she'll find you.
She'll find you because that is the deal that you made.
That's the deal.
That's the problem.
And it's a great thing. It's a beautiful thing.
Uh-huh. Listen, I also, let's, can we just at some point, not even now, just break down the psychology of James Cameron wanting to go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench?
James Cameron and water, in general. I just want to know.
The
best behind the scenes feature that there is out there is like a 3-hour look at the making of The Abyss. If you haven't watched it, please go watch it. I'm sure it's on YouTube and the quality is terrible, but it is, this man is obsessed with the ocean. He got Titanic made. The reason he says he wanted to make Titanic was because the studio would pay for him to dive to the Titanic.
Let's be clear. He is Bill Paxton's character in Titanic.
And, absolutely.
And that whole idea of like, I never got it, never let it in. He still didn't let it in, number one.
He still has let nothing in.
Number two.
As Avatar 2 comes out after 15 years.
And my further proof of this is another documentary. If you go on Disney Plus, there's The Making of Titanic. It's like a National Geographic, like it's both the making of the movie Titanic and like revisiting the Titanic, you know, however many years after the movie was made. And you literally, this is a documentary that was EP'd by James Cameron at the end of, or I'd say probably the last quarter of which is interspersed with like the ancestors of survivors of the Titanic coming forward to Mr. Cameron and saying, we just want to thank you for your work about keeping our story alive. This is a movie that he
this
built.
Is a humble man. This is a humble, humble man. Have you watched the Kevin Hart documentary he made about himself?
I refuse. There's a Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart, the comedian, made a documentary about himself with his company, his own camera team, a feature length documentary, you know, and he was publicizing it like, get ready, like, this is my story, raw and uncut and all this stuff. And he has controversy, right? Things that he said, and he had to step down from the Oscars and all this stuff. He made some tweets. You'd think, okay, this is going to be like basically like an explanation for that, right? This movie, if you liked him before or had no thoughts about him before, you will walk away from this documentary hating this man.
Wow.
I have not been able to stomach a Kevin Hart anything since I watched his documentary that he made about himself. Because it basically, it's a non-apology for every single thing and just shows you how he probably did mean all those things. Like, he's pretty surface about who he is, right? You can't really hide in that kind of like, you know, raw behind the scenes stuff. He's not acting. He's just being himself. And you see, oh, this guy's full of himself. He's a complete narcissist, and he absolutely believes the things that he says.
Well, see, here's what I question, though, and this is something for us to, as our careers continue, you know, not to say that we will ever get to Kevin Hart level or any of these people's level, but is that something, you know, I think about the celebrities that, like, I really love and, like, look up to, and they are people who seem to be able to maintain, beyond a performative chill, just a sense of like understanding that like the world does not revolve around them. And because like, here's what I will say, as much as like, if you guys follow The Rock on Instagram, as much as this man is insane, what I also will point out is that The Rock actually makes a huge point of like making a platform for American people and giving back. And like,
He's genuine.
He's genuine.
He's a genuine human. And you get the sense that when the cameras stop rolling, he's still the same person that was there when they were.
Yeah. And like, it's all a manipulation, right? Because at that, when you're that big, you are truly, and especially now when like part of your business as that kind of celebrity seems to be making your life into your art, like your brand is your art.
Yeah.
So like people want, there's what you do on screen, and then there's the life that you show people that you have, and there's what's actually going on that we shouldn't get to know about because that's your actual life, right? But even in the life that he shows us, I'm just like, you know what? Like you there's a lot going on with you, Mr. Dwayne Johnson, but like you seem like you're a chill dude. Like you actually do, and you can tell that about a person. And anybody, I guess all I'm saying is this. I have no judgment on Kevin Hart. I think he's funny as hell. But I, no matter how big I get, Alex, the day that I decide to make a documentary about myself is the day when I want you to personally come and put me down. And you have my full permission
Yes, sir.
You've been waiting for those words.
See that, and that's his thing, is like, because you know he's sitting in a PR meeting, be like, okay, like what can we do? And the meetings are in the documentary, right, with his team. Like, what can our company do with this brand to enhance it? And like, oh, every great artist has a documentary that has been made about them.
No,
like,
they don't.
We should tell people our story. It's like, yeah, these people, if they do, they did not make it themselves.
No, and like. I will say I think it's really cool that like there is a behind the curtain so that you can understand how manufactured it is.
But it's not behind the curtain if he is the one with the curtain.
I would agree. I would agree with that.
Like
I would agree with that.
He's just showing you more stage behind his curtain.
Yes.
Like,
yes. Yeah.
And failing to do so, like the stuff he does let in, you know, he like there's like footage of him like berating his friends on a plane because he gets drunk and like yells at his friend for like, he's like, I pay for everything and you don't have any respect, whatever. Like getting mad at his friend for kind of mooching off him, even though that's the arrangement, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, I was really sorry I did that.
But see, that's part of the reason why, like, as much as I love The Last Dance, I couldn't fully get behind it. Because it was such a, like, Jordan, the first shot is literally Jordan sitting in his, like, 20-foot windowed living room.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and like just smoking a cigar, and like when I reflect upon my life, and it's like Jesus freaking Christ, Forrest. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you know,
I like The Last Dance not because I don't think it told me anything. It was just like the story of the team, which I only knew bits and pieces of. I didn't think it was great at breaking down who these guys were because it doesn't really matter.
No,
you know, I think they're all pretty public in their, you know, who they are.
Yeah. But
in terms of like documentary storytelling and use of, I mean, whatever team they had finding these clips and these pictures and the, oh my God.
But I just, you know, it's so funny that we talk about these movies, you know, from even Moon, which is from 2009, you know, which is now a bygone era. It's so funny how celebrity has changed. And in the time, you know, Humphrey Bogart, you know, like part of the mystique of the movie stars of the 40s was you didn't know too much about their life. Do you mean like you only got glimpses? And so you would have like, you'd be like, oh man, I want to live like, you know, Howard Hughes, because he's always with, you know, blah, 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 going to these parties. And that's how you'd see him. You would never see the fact that this man was, you know, crippled by anxiety and all this stuff. But now, all of that stuff, there's so much that you actually not have to make public, but like can choose to make public that will boost your status in the world. And you, in again, like this kind of performative public thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, back then too, you had, you know, I'm sure tabloid manipulation was a thing, right? Like placing celebrities at certain, it was just more of a craft that required a team of like people who knew what they were doing to try to build the public, you know. It's basically just convincing people of your life. So social media has taken that and given that power to basically everybody.
Everybody.
But like, yeah, as a celebrity, it's
crazy.
A whole other game.
It's a whole other game. But you know, I think you know what Rick would say to that?
What's that?
He'd say,
frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
No, Alec, that's not. Well, you know what? Sure, that's what Rick would. Yeah, that's exactly what Rick would say. Frankly, my dears, I don't give a damn. You know, he would be quoting a horribly racist movie from 10 years.
I got to go back to film school.
Yeah, you really.
Some actor from that was still alive from Gone with the Wind just died. Somebody was still alive who was in that movie.
Seriously? Was it a child in that movie?
Let me just Google
it. Yeah, Google it up because.
It must have been one of the child actors.
Yeah, it had to be a child. Because good Lord.
Olivia de Havilland, last remaining Gone with the Wind actor who played Melanie Wilkes, dies at 104.
Wow. Good for you.
No, she's like a young woman. She looks to be maybe somewhere between 14 to 17.
Incredible.
In Gone with the Wind. Incredible. Died at 104.
Dude, what a life.
Godspeed.
Godspeed.
What a life.
I think about like if you've lived over a century, you are an automatic hero.
Oh, you got it.
You know what I mean? You did it. You did the thing. So, I mean, good for you.
All right. Well, so, Sarah, when's she coming back to you? How long you got to endure this? How many classic movies are you going to have to watch?
So many. So many. I mean, theoretically, I'm going out there, you know, September 1st. So that will be, four or five weeks from now. But we will see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, it's crazy times, but these movies, as always, get us through.
Yes.
So yes, tweet at us, get us with your movie picks for
It's okay if you don't have a wife or a husband.
Yeah, it's okay.
This can be, you know, use your imagination.
Yeah, use that brain power, you know, get in there.
Use it.
But as always, always a pleasure, my friends.
We'll see you next time.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.